What the Alaska Native tribes need from NCAI is your support. We need tribal governments across the nation to say, just as Alaska Natives are saying, that this is our land. These are our communities, our people, our ways, our culture. We predate any other people by many thousands of years. We were sovereign when you came to this country, and we are sovereign today.
That's the message of Will Mayo of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, Regional Vice President of the National Congress of American Indians, the national lobbying organization for Native Americans. They're in Fairbanks for their mid-year conference to discuss current development and policy for Natives across the nation. Alaska Natives are determined to maintain their distinct culture and identity, and Mayo had sharp words for the oft-heard theory of this society as the melting pot.
And there are others in this state and in this nation who would like to see us assimilated and blended in the great melting pot that they claim is the United States of America. But I appreciated what I heard from a Native leader regarding this melting pot. It says that all of the good stuff sinks to the bottom, and all of the scum rises to the top in the melting pot.
Self-determination for Alaska Natives is what they're seeking, Mayo says, and that needs to start with recognition of Native villages as legitimate tribes and government. He says that's something everyone in the state has to recognize.
I think what Alaska Native tribes are looking for is the acknowledgement of what is rightfully ours in terms of our self-governance and our culture and our tribes. And I think that given the fact that Alaska Natives have contributed so heavily to the land base of this land, of this state, a recognition, an acknowledgement of their rights as a people should be given and acknowledged by the population as a whole.
In Fairbanks, I'm Gary Fife.
It's my understanding on Tuesday that the FDIC will move the offer back to Alaska, and at that time, the actual signing and the property transfer will be taking place. Basically, until everybody's signed in the bottom line, it's not done. There's a number of owners involved, and until that's all finalized, it wouldn't be done. But I suspect that it would be done within the next 2 to 3 weeks.
3, 2, 1. When Health and Safety Director Dick Jackson signed back on with the borough a few months ago, he came with certain goals in mind. One of them was to get a new emergency fire and medical service plan going. But things are moving slowly. That ordinance still hasn't been approved. Jackson says the mayor's proposal to cut the dumpster service in the borough was another attempt to get some clear policy set for his department. But with the borough assembly committed to continue operating the dumpsters, he's not getting much help there either.
The attempt was made, of course, to have them decide some long-term policy. We had taken a possibility of working that problem out to the assembly, and they have yet to discuss it, which was to eliminate some of the dumpster sites and put in immediate transfer stations. And the assembly has yet to discuss that. So we gave them the answer. We were attempting to get them to decide a policy direction, and that attempt was made in the budget by withdrawing the dumpsters. Obviously didn't work. It's just another example of a lack of policy direction as far as solid waste goes. It's sort of drifting.
Jackson turned in his letter of resignation more than a month ago, with August 10th as the effective date. Mayor Juanita Helm says he's not ready to accept it yet.
In like a month, we may sit down and reassess whether he feels that he's accomplished what he wants to and whether there is a possibility of an extension. I know he came up here with a limited period of time in mind, so we knew it wasn't going to be permanent, but the longer we can keep him here, the better I'd like it.
Whether he stays a while longer or leaves in August, Jackson says the slow movement of things hasn't left him mad.
No, I'm not mad. Frustrated, but not mad. There's a difference.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Assemblymember Don Lowell is part owner of the warehouse that the borough began leasing a few years ago under Mayor Bill Allen's administration.
Members of the assembly have reviewed the lease several times before, and they keep looking for something hidden in there. There's nothing.
But during last week's budget meetings, Donna Gilbert raised enough questions about the lease to get the rest of the assembly interested. Anyone who heard the discussion also heard Joe Ryan bring up the issue of ethics and Don Lowell's response.
I think we have a little ethics problem here, and I'd like to amend this particular motion to have this whole matter brought before the Ethics Committee.
That's a pretty crummy statement to make, Mr. Ryan. You can infer anything you want. Who is the head of the Ethics Committee? You? You're a fine person for ethics.
Assembly members say the lease payments amount to more than $100,000 a year. After talking about the lease last week, Assemblymember Harold Gillum thinks it may be time to look for any other space that might be available.
I think in fairness to Mr. Lowell, since he is a member of the assembly, that we do everything up and above board, and I think that we should ask for a new request for proposals. I think we can better ourselves, better our lease arrangement. We probably should have gone for a request for proposal a couple years ago when warehouse space was a lot cheaper than it is today. But this lease was initially in 1985 when lease warehouse space was at a premium, and that's the rate we're paying today.
The assembly will discuss the matter at a special 6:30 meeting tonight. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
We are focused very much on successful projects, not on reports. And in fact, we fund very few, if any, projects that simply end up as a report, because there are more people writing reports than reading them. And it just doesn't happen unless you can make sure that the process of innovation is understood and carried out. And so we're trying to teach that. We get some that are what I call trust me proposals. You know, I can't really tell you about what my technology is, but trust me, if you give me the money, you'll be very happy with the results. We can't fund those. We get proposals. We've gotten a couple proposals for perpetual motion machines. They're just not technically or scientifically valid. We can't fund those. We get proposals that are reinventions of the wheel. People have not looked at what was already out there and what had been done. And in those cases, we don't fund those either. And on the other extreme, we get proposals for what would probably be good ideas, but they are essentially a standard business in competition with another business in the state. And we don't fund those. They have to involve research or development. We don't pay to set somebody up in business. The Science and Technology Foundation and the grants from the foundation are the means to achieving this, not the end. We have a two-step process. There's a pre-proposal, which is 2 pages long. And I read every one of those and write a response to every one of them saying, and there have been 500 so far, saying, this is how your technology looks to us. If you do choose to submit a proposal to us, these are the things you should do to give you a better chance of getting it funded. Or it may say, it doesn't look like this fits, but you can still submit a proposal if you'd like. What we're trying to do is do two things. One, let people know what kind of chance they have of getting funded. And two, make sure that the proposals we get are better. What we hope to do over time is to build a network of assistance groups all over the state.
Three, two, one. The tapestry is called Ancient Rhythms. Charlotte Van Zant says it's her concept of seasonality. The long, narrow tapestry is alive with activity. It's not the images of man that attract your attention, though. It's the brightly colored fish and caribou spanning the piece.
I guess first let's start and say it's very colorful. It's meant to portray seasons, but not just the brief annual seasons either. It's long term. It's long, thousands upon thousands of years for me. There's a geological layer to it. There's the animals, and then there's the humans, and then there's the passage of time with these planetary bodies moving across it. Then there's the concept of solar winds, auroral winds, Chinooks, these ribbons of color that are moving across this. The animals are moving across as if they're in a migratory pattern. The little humans are, it's a combination of being hunters and also being dancers. They're celebrating. They're celebrating life for me.
Van Zandt also wove a few handprints across the tapestry, denoting the constant attempts by humans to make their mark on things. She sketched her design onto a huge piece of paper the exact size of the tapestry, called a cartoon. Then she places the cartoon behind a huge frame, hand-built and threaded specifically for this project. She handpicks each thread through the giant harp-like frame by color, not line.
For this kind of weaving, it's almost better to do it all one by one by hand. It's very controlled, and you can achieve extremely intricate results. See, I'm not pattern weaving, so I don't need every thread all the way across coming up in sequences like you do when you're weaving yardage or things like that. I only need just the area that I'm weaving, because I weave only in the area I'm using right at the moment. This is much more like you'd see with Navajo rug weaving or things that I would call more of a, what you think of as a folk type weaving, something out of a little bit less machine-oriented culture. You don't have to have all that equipment to do intricate work.
Van Zandt buys as much of the material for the tapestry that she can locally. The $20,000 commission under the 1% for Art program covers her whole budget, from lumber for the frame to Alaskan wool that she hand dyes. Some of that yarn is also hand spun, so the texture is more fuzzy than smooth. Van Zandt says that's the fiber that gives the piece a lively surface texture.
I think of it as analogous to a painter who paints for the surface quality of the paint, being kind of rich and juicy paint built up on the canvas, and you know, where you see the brush strokes and things. I want to do that with fiber. I don't want it to be sloppy, but I want it to have that kind of richness that you see the stroke, the movement, the hand involved, rather than a piece that's so finely surfaced and finely finished that you really don't see that there was a human being behind it.
Other tapestries by Van Zandt hang in pioneers' homes in Ketchikan and Anchorage, correctional centers in Bethel and Fairbanks, and schools in Seward and the Matsu Valley. This tapestry is also a state commission, part of the 1% for Art program with the new University Park Elementary School. It was done with help from Michelle Ambrose, Shelley Swanson, and Nancy Hosley Johnson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Talk centered around the Alaska Railroad's response to the train derailment and fuel spill so far, and where the cleanup effort is headed. On-scene coordinator Pete McGee says by today he wants steps taken to ensure better containment of the fuel in the beaver ponds on either side of the railroad track, and he wants a continuous pumping system set up to get the fuel picked up. But McGee also hopes to get a better long-term plan from the railroad.
We'd like to have something in hand, you know, by Monday that deals with a longer-term effort than just recovering the product off the pond. With the thickness of it that's out there right now and the beaver ponds that have it contained, we would expect that to be a pretty short-term process.
Others at yesterday's meeting want the railroad to consider impact on the area's natural habitat and address that in a long-term plan. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Other fires in the interior have raised the question of fire suppression measures at the spill site. humidity and warm temperatures have been common lately, and the fuel spill occurred outside any area with fire protection. On-scene coordinator Pete McGee says it's a legitimate concern.
You could pump water out from underneath in either the creek or the ponds, and there's, I mean, you could generate a lot of water to fight a fire there, but boy, if there really was a fire, you couldn't get to those ponds. I mean, you'd have to move farther away and just kind of evacuate the area because there's a lot of fuel on the water right now.
The need for fire suppression measures was raised at a meeting yesterday of all the agencies involved in the spill cleanup. Alaska Railroad officials at the meeting expressed interest in pursuing some of the suggestions that were made to handle the problem. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. More than 30 people crowded into a small conference room at the Department of Environmental Conservation's Fairbanks office. They got an update on the spill cleanup and looked over maps to determine just how far some fuel may have traveled.
Well, that's the refuge here.
Right.
Oh, okay, so we're actually quite a ways.
Most of the fuel is resting in ponds on either side of the derailment site at Dunbar, but seams have been spotted in Goldstream Creek, and there's concern on potential impact to the Minto Flats State Game Refuge and the Tanana Valley State Forest.
The seams are disappearing right now, at least, right where it gets right to the edge of the refuge boundary, so it cuts back over here.
The yellow is the allotment.
Containment measures are in place, and the Department of Environmental Conservation's on-scene coordinator Pete McGee says he wants to ensure those containment measures.
We don't want to trust the beaver dams all to themselves to hold up the fuel. The sorbent booms, the actual containment booms with real skirts on them need to be in place upstream of the beaver dams and then downstream in the creek where if it rains or we get high water or one of the beaver dams happens to fail for some reason, we don't lose all of this stuff down the creek.
Representatives of groups with an interest in the area attended the meeting, and Anna resident Mitch Dementev raised some native concerns.
We'd like to keep on top of the situation with regard to containment as well as recovery, and we're interested in a long-term recovery of the area. We don't want to see any of that fuel get into the Minto Flats any more than already has.
Many of the questions yesterday centered around getting a long-term plan from the Alaska Railroad that addresses some of the concerns about cleanup and containment of the fuel. Rex Blazer with the Northern Alaska Environmental Center says he'll also be looking at how the whole spill cleanup is handled.
And we're also looking down the road at this process as how it relates to the transportation by the Alaska Railroad of hydrocarbons and the responsibility of the railroad for contingency planning and the way this process is going to come down in the future. I think, we're all hopefully going to learn some lessons from all of this.
Mike Oden heads the Local Emergency Planning Committee, a group assigned to ensure proper handling of spills like this. Oden says a major concern now is that nothing's been done to handle any fire that might break out at the spill site.
The location of it puts it outside of any local fire service jurisdiction in the Fairbanks area. You take the weather conditions, which is approximately 25% humidity and the high temperature makes extremely high static conditions. And when you're dealing with flammable liquids as this is, any spark, static spark, electricity, a non-explosion proof motor, welding torch can set this thing off, and once it's set off, then you've got a massive fire. Just the weekend before, we've had the big fires in Anderson and Clear, is they just can't contain it, and you add 100,000 gallons of flammable liquids to it, then we've got a major fire. And being outside of a fire service area, no one's going to respond to it.
Al Townsend with the Department of Fish and Game was sitting at the table and offered a suggestion for handling that problem.
We may have two problems with one. We could pump water from under the oil, reduce the flow of solubles into the creek,
bring
the levels down in the pond, yet have the water in tank cars available with pumps as a initial fire suppressant. Is that feasible?
Definitely worth looking at and see what we can do, yes. Yeah.
Yesterday's meeting was the first of what they hope will be daily meetings. On-scene coordinator Pete McGee wants a long-term plan by Monday's meeting addressing some of the points already raised. And by the second meeting today, McGee says he wants to see a system for continuous pumping and recovery of fuel at the site.
There are pumps out there. There's two super suckers out there. There's hoses out there. There's crews out there. If there's small things that are missing to get this rolling here, we need to fix whatever it is those are. And we'd like to see a continuous 24-hour-a-day recovery system. The last time I looked at the fuel, the estimates range from like 1 inch to 4 inches deep on those ponds. So there's a substantial amount of fuel that would be relatively easy to recover with pumping. This fill was in one of the best natural areas I've seen for actually containing the product. You already had the beaver dams there. You were real lucky. Very little fuel, although some, has gone down the creek. And it's there to be picked up. Tomorrow will be the fourth day that we're going into the cleanup on the spill, and we need to make sure we pick that all up.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
We have been concerned all along about the shutdown due to the rail traffic in are trying to ensure that the recovery continues at the maximum rate possible in spite of that. And if it turns out that it, for some reason, those railroad trains going through there are still slowing down the recovery, then either we need to put in some longer hoses and pump straight to the end of the tracks or make some other arrangements to make sure that we recover that product as fast as we can. They use the super suckers to do that. They bring the rail train back onto the tracks, suck out of the tank sitting off the side of the tracks, and pump into one of the rail cars on the tracks to haul the fuel away. But in the meantime, they can keep pumping into those other tanks. So on one, they've got our old rail car on one side, and they've got those fast tanks on the other side. So, in theory at least, they would be able to keep continuous recovery going if this all works right. If the pumps don't break down and the crews stay on shift and that kind of stuff. So hopefully they can do that. Now the next question will be, is the number of pumps and the rate of recovery and the things they've got adequate? And that's why we were asking for the pumping capacity and the gallons recovered per day and how much of that was water versus fuel is to start establishing how fast they're actually getting water off or oil off the water and ensure that rate's fast enough. In a matter of hours or a day or two at the most, they should be able to have that stuff sucked up. It's like an inch thick floating on those ponds. There's no reason that they can't pump close to pure product. They don't, with the right skimming devices on the ends of their pumps, they don't have to suck up very much water. And it shouldn't take very long to recover it down to a thin film or a sheen. That'll take a little more effort then because it'll start coming out of the grass and stuff, but to get the major volume of liquid floating on the water, of fuel floating on the water, they should be able to do that quickly.
3, 2, 1. American veterans of the war were among the welcoming group at Fairbanks International Airport Thursday. More than 50 Russians disembarked from the plane. Some were officials, some journalists, and some veteran pilots who haven't been back here since the war. Soviet pilots were stationed in Alaska back in 1942 under what's known as the Lend-Lease program. Planes needed by the Soviet Union during the war were made in the United States and flown to Alaska. Pilots here then flew them over to Russia. That went on until the fall of 1945. Viktor Yeltsikov wasn't a pilot, but a radio operator at Ladd Field during the war.
И сейчас живем мирно, дружно, и мы очень хотим, чтобы никогда войны не было, и чтобы
that, to celebrate the victory over Germany in the war, and to continue also that we can keep living peacefully, so that kids, grandchildren can all live in a peaceful world.
Yeltsikov hasn't been back here since 1945, but he's planning to look up some old friends.
Где мы вместе, как говорится, жили, отдыхали, где мы вместе готовили самолеты, вылетали, и может быть даже встретимся с
друзьями нашими, которыми мы вместе работали, rest and meet their old friends if they're still around.
Glad to see you. Welcome. Thank you.
Fairbanks is the second stop for this group. They came here from Nome and have a host of things planned before leaving for Anchorage on Saturday. Those plans involve looking ahead to 1992, the 50th anniversary of the Lend-Lease program. A larger celebration and reunion is scheduled here then. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
Welcome. Glad you could come. Nice to see you. Welcome to you.
Three, two, one. Keeping the spilled fuel contained and getting it picked up are DEC on-scene coordinator Pete McGee's top priorities now. The railroad's coordinator, Obie Weeks, told McGee that recovery is continuous, but trains have slowed some things on occasion.
And the super suckers were working further up to the north on the right-hand side, and of course that operation is dependent upon track time, so they, when the trains come, that operation shut down. The others are completely independent of train operation.
So there is continuous recovery on both sides of the tracks, and then you're using the super suckers in addition whenever you can.
Right.
The two talked about the recovery at a spill coordination meeting in Fairbanks yesterday. By mid-afternoon Thursday, about 50,000 gallons of fuel and water had been pumped from the site. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. An oil duck was spotted at the spill site yesterday. During a spill cleanup meeting, Elaine Snyder-Kahn of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service asked Dale Nelson if the Alaska Railroad is prepared to pay for things if more injured animals are found.
Because it's a very expensive proposition, and the service is out of money from Prince William Sound.
That's addressed.
Is, beg your pardon?
Was that an issue we'll just have to address? You know, with the
we need an answer pretty soon on that, because I have a feeling that people will be starting to box them and hand them to me, and I'm going to be handing them to you.
Snyder-Kahn says the Fish and Wildlife Service wants any dead birds that are recovered and wants to hear about injured birds that cannot be captured. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one.
We don't have a cause of accident right now. There were no injuries. We expect it will cost us about $500,000 to do the cleanup and the repairs.
Alaska Railroad spokeswoman Vivian Hamilton says it was a typical train leaving Fairbanks on Monday. It carried jet aircraft and diesel fuel from the Masco refinery in North Pole. But just 30 miles north of Nenana, 19 cars went off the track in a relatively unpopulated marshy area. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is supervising the railroad's cleanup effort. Spokeswoman Barbara Holian says 15 of the tank cars were leaking at the scene.
The fuel drained into beaver ponds on both sides of the track. The railroad closed the dam to try to keep water from running from the pond. One of the dikes was made of soil, the other of plywood with a sorbent pad on both sides. The sorbent pad will soak up the product. Most of the fuel was being contained by the dam on the upper end of the west side of the beaver dam. We're hoping that the beavers did go away. Often they do when something like this happens.
Since the accident happened near Goldstream Creek, Holian says they are reviewing impact on that waterway.
Goldstream Creek is approximately 200 yards from the railroad. There are small sheens in Goldstream Creek, oil sheens that is, and a boom has been placed in the main drainage ditch. At this time, large amounts of oil are not expected to reach Goldstream Creek.
Yesterday, Fairbanks area wildlife biologist Mark McNay flew over the spill site between Fairbanks and Nenana.
We could see a definite sheen in the presence of fuel oil in Goldstream Creek for a distance of at least 3 airline miles downstream of the spill site, and that would probably be 5 or 6 miles along the course of the creek. It appears that the fuel had just reached the first of a large series of lake systems which spread out through Mento Flats, and beyond that point, though, into the lake systems, we did not see any evidence of fuel, but it was obvious that there was a considerable amount of fuel upstream in Goldstream Creek itself.
McNay is with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He says much of the impact on wildlife there will be determined over time.
It's hard to say, just viewing it from the air, exactly how much of the diesel fuel has gotten into the water, but it undoubtedly will have an impact on aquatic life of some sort and potentially on waterfowl. Right now in the creek itself, there's not large concentrations of waterfowl. At this point, I don't see that it's caused significant amount of damage, but it only, as time goes on, we'll be able to assess exactly what the final impact will be. I do believe there will be some impact on wildlife. Of course, all the aquatic mammals, mink, otter, muskrat, beaver, it flows down a creek that has all those animals in it, so they will be affected to some degree. Whether it will cause direct death or contamination of their food sources, that's something we'll just have to wait and see.
Fish and Game officials were also on the ground to look at the spill area yesterday. The Department of Natural Resources and the EPA are also involved in assessing the cleanup effort. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
The fuel drained into beaver ponds on both sides of the track. The railroad's Caterpillar tractor last night closed the dam to try to keep water from running from the pond. One of the spikes was made of soil, the other of plywood with a sorbent pad on both sides. The sorbent pad will soak up the product. Most of the fuel is being contained by the dam on the upper end of the west side of the beaver dam. The danger comes in that they contain more soluble elements, aromatic hydrocarbons like benzene, but on a scale of 5 for the most toxic, and 0 being the least toxic or lacking toxicity at all. The Jet A and the diesel grades 2 and 4 are about a 2.5 on that scale of 0 to 5. That gives you an idea of the kind of toxicity we're dealing with. There is a high degree of immediate toxicity, so there'll be a lot of fumes at the site, and of course we would ask people to not travel to the site just to see the spill. We're hoping that the beavers did go away. Often they do when something like this happens.
Cut one coming in 3, 2, 1. No one was injured when 19 train cars derailed Monday afternoon south of Fairbanks, Alaska. Alaska Railroad spokeswoman Vivian Hamilton says the 68-car train was carrying jet and diesel fuel from Fairbanks to Anchorage.
About 100,000 gallons of fuel spilled at the site. We've been able to contain it right at the track, and we're working to clean it up right now.
No one was evacuated since the accident occurred near a marshy, unpopulated area. Railroad officials still haven't determined what caused the accident. In Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm Ann Thornton. Cut two in 3, 2, 1. Some 100,000 gallons of jet and diesel fuel spilled Monday in Alaska when a train derailed. Alaska Railroad spokeswoman Vivian Hamilton says 19 of the train's 68 cars went off the track about 40 miles south of Fairbanks.
There were no injuries. We expect it will cost us about $500,000 to do the cleanup and the repairs.
The train was headed from Fairbanks to Anchorage. The accident occurred in a sparsely populated area, so no one was evacuated. In Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. On Friday night, DEC on-scene coordinator Pete McGee gave the railroad exactly 72 hours to get the bulk of the fuel cleaned up. McGee paid a visit to the spill site Friday and called the recovery effort pretty pathetic.
We're not very happy with the rate of recovery going on out there, to say the least. And it takes a substantial increase in the number of personnel and a substantial increase in the number of pumps and equipment and resources. The magnitude of the problem didn't seem to be registering on all the people that we talked with out there in the field. I mean, there just wasn't nearly the effort that needs to be in place out there.
Over the weekend, the railroad hired a consulting firm to help with cleanup operations. The railroad's board of directors is meeting in Anchorage this morning to talk about the spill 1 week after it happened. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 2-1. At the first two spill coordination meetings, state and federal agencies were offering the railroad suggestions for cleaning up the spill. By Friday afternoon, patience was wearing thin. DEC on-scene coordinator Pete McGee had taken a trip to the site and didn't see much going on. He told the railroad officials to get more people and more equipment out there and get the more than 100,000 gallons of fuel picked up. After questioning whether the railroad understood the magnitude of the problem, he pressed for the same information that they had been asking for all along.
We're asking you these questions. How much gallons are actually floating on the water, and what's the rate of recovery that you're going to get off the water so we can make some decision about how many of these pumps or how much equipment we need. And if it's going to take 10 or 15 days to suck up the stuff, we're going to say no deal. You know, double, triple, whatever you need to do to get the stuff. I mean, I mentioned a couple of meetings ago that we were talking about recovering this stuff in hours, not in days, and we're at day five. So anyway, it was pretty pathetic today, actually, to show up out there and not see any recovery going on.
Others at the meeting also questioned the slow cleanup process. Nenana resident Mitch Dementis criticized both the railroad and the DEC, saying the railroad was more concerned with getting back to business, and the DEC needs to start insisting things get done. Some insistence did come later. The DEC wrote a letter to the railroad's cleanup commander, telling him to get enough equipment out there to have the bulk of the fuel picked up by 10 o'clock tonight, 72 hours from when the letter was written. At Sunday's spill coordination meeting, the railroad's environmental engineer, Dale Nelson, had a letter of his own for the DEC.
The letter that I just signed to give to Pete is saying that we are going to meet the requirements of the 90% of the product as a floatable, removable product, and then another 5 days to get this in the marshes, as I reported yesterday.
Several things did happen over the weekend to pick up the pace at the spill site. Crews and equipment were added. The railroad also hired a consulting firm to help deal with the long-term aspects of the cleanup, and they've been at the site. Their latest estimates are that between 15 and 19,000 gallons of fuel and water is being picked up per hour. DEC spokesman Chuck Cresciolti says the 10 o'clock deadline tonight was one way for the DEC to let the railroad know they mean business.
But it was basically a deadline to make it clear to the railroad that we were extremely serious about wanting to mobilize the assisted equipment and the efficiency of the equipment to get the fuel off the ponds in no more than 3 more days' time from when we issued the letter Friday night. And there certainly has been a significant increase in material that's been committed and manpower that's been committed. And now it's just a question of making the process work efficiently to get the remaining oil off.
The railroad also plans to submit its long-term cleanup plan today. That was requested last week when state officials felt all the fuel would be picked up by now. The long-term plan is supposed to address restoration of the area when all the fuel is recovered. And the Alaska Railroad Board of Directors scheduled a special meeting today in Anchorage to talk about the train derailment and the spill cleanup efforts. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. Many of the people who spoke out at the meeting couldn't hide their emotions. Several have friends or family members living at Denali Center now. They don't want the nursing home to close, and if it does, they want more than 2 months' time to relocate their loved ones. State Commissioner of Health and Human Services Myra Munson agrees that it's all happening too fast. Her agency sets Medicaid rates to reimburse the center for patient care. The money isn't enough to run the type of operation that the Greater Fairbanks Community Hospital Foundation thinks it should be running. Munson attended the meeting yesterday after trying earlier in the day to get the foundation to rethink its decision and recommit to Denali Center. She believes with some work and a little more time, they can work out the finances and eventually get a new nursing home built.
We're asking for more time, and we're asking them to consider using the system better. The rate-setting system is very complicated, and the foundation has played, and the Lutherans have played, very ethically, very prudently, very conservatively, and as a result, they're not using the system well, and so some nursing homes are surviving better, than Denali Center. And so today, I express, again, frustration I've expressed for the last 2 years with Denali Center, which is, you don't like our system, I don't like our system, but at least use it for the benefit of the patients in this program. Today we talked brass tacks. We really sat down and said, well, what if you did this and this and this? And why don't you do this? And if you do these things, that's a lot of money. And it's not the $10 million you need, but it's the planning money. At least it's enough to cause you to reconsider your decision, if not as a permanent decision, at least to give more time to the community. There was one member of the board, the president was there, and the Lutheran Home Administration people, they couldn't make a commitment. I felt a rekindling of optimism when I left, but I can't speak for whether it will be enough. Part of me says it just has to be enough. The things that people said here today, we just can't not have a nursing home in our community.
Even if the foundation doesn't want to continue operating Denali Center, Munson thinks the board should at least put off the closure for one full year to give some other group a chance to take over. Buying time will also allow community support to build for saving nursing home care in the interior, like it did so many years ago when the hospital was built. Some feel the community can pull together again to save Denali Center, but it's a commitment that needs time to build, and Commissioner Munson says 2 months won't do it.
This isn't enough time for people to do the things people here were committing to do, which is to get involved and help make different decisions. This community deserves a year, and there is no detriment to the hospital in giving that time. There's no threat to this community except from a precipitous decision.
One side effect of the meeting may be a burst in membership to the hospital foundation. Some who aren't happy with the Board of Trustees' decision talked about joining the foundation to make changes from within. Board members were criticized by people who felt there was no warning that Denali Center might close, and close less than 3 months from when the decision was made. The Lutheran Health and Home Society runs the center and is scheduled to consider agreeing to the August 15th closing date at a meeting this week. Bill Mendenhall was one of a few foundation board members who did attend the meeting. He told the group that the decision wasn't a hasty one, nor was it easy, and he doesn't know that it will be reversed.
If there's some drastic change, I think that would certainly, if the state can pay, if there can be other arrangements, might make a difference. I don't think the group is willing to just go on a proposition where we're just spending money. We can't improve the building. It needs improving. And just to continue running for a while, we're not going to get anywhere.
Fairbanks Memorial Hospital Administrator Jim Gingrich plans to take the many comments to the Lutheran Home Society meeting later this week. He says it's possible the suggestions and concern may make a difference, but he also told the group he doesn't want to give false hope. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
I was out there today. The product is like an eighth of an inch thick compared to an inch and a quarter, an inch and a half that it was. I mean, they have made substantial progress on removing product off the water. There was a fair amount of equipment running. A lot of it was working. They're short of personnel to keep it all running at top efficiency. And they agreed at the meeting to add 10 more people to each of the shifts, which is roughly a 50% increase in the size of their crews. So hopefully that will help.
Three, two, one. The move to hire an additional contractor pleases officials with the Department of Environmental Conservation, who've been asking the railroad to get more cleanup workers at the site. On-scene coordinator Pete McGee says he still saw places yesterday where people could have helped move the process along.
And we don't mean to just ask for people for the sake of asking for people, but when you walk around and it looks like there's a lot of things that somebody ought to be doing, you need more. And the people that we saw there were working real hard. I mean, they were, you know, there weren't a bunch of people off, you know, not being productive. I mean, they were, looked like they were all working, and they were all working real hard. So, it's, you know, it's just a matter of getting enough.
By this morning, a crew from the new contractor, Martech, should be on the site. Alaska Railroad environmental engineer Dale Nelson says the contractor that's been there since the beginning, Verka, will continue cleanup work while Martech workers concentrate on picking up fuel spilled on the river.
We'll have 28 people at the site and that doesn't mean they're all going to be on the river. There'll be people in boats, people on the banks, people tending booms. We're going to get the job done. We're concerned enough that we've just kicked that into gear.
Much of the fuel that was considered easily recoverable because it was floating on ponds in the wetlands area is slowly being picked up. The railroad hasn't recovered it all yet, and the recent rains have increased the amount of fuel to be picked up off the pond surface. Railroad officials say more than 700,000 gallons of fuel and water have been taken from the spill location. They can't say what percentage of that amount is fuel. The latest calculations by the Environmental Protection Agency estimate that 45 to 50,000 gallons of fuel have actually been recovered, and more than 150,000 gallons of jet and diesel fuel were spilled. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
After a briefing by Budget Director Allison Elgee, Cooper told Capitol reporters that the continued downturn in North Slope oil prices is raising serious questions of a deficit in the budget for fiscal year 1991 that begins July 1st. Cooper says even relying on a spring revenue forecast that pegged prices at a rosy $19 a barrel, the legislature went over the top by $65 million.
I think that people need to know that the spending this year was in excess of an optimistic view of available revenues, and that obviously we can't have an unbalanced budget. We're not allowed to have one.
Cooper refused to say what he might do to balance the budget, but he did target a $150 million appropriation to the permanent fund as the main cause of the possible deficit.
Well, I mention that because it is the direct cause of the over expenditure. If that had not appeared in the budget at the last minute, then there would have been a surplus shown at about $90 million or so. My view of that is that even that would be optimistic.
The permanent fund appropriation originated in the 1988 debate over the Elf oil tax revision. The agreement to put some of the extra oil money into the fund was seen as key to obtaining the votes to get the Elf through the Senate. Cooper could reduce or eliminate that appropriation with his veto pen, or he could ask the legislature to make the appropriation contingent on there being enough money in the Treasury to cover it. That could only be done in a special session. Cooper denied that there was a connection between the permanent fund deposit and his efforts to bring the legislature back in special session to deal with subsistence. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
3, 2, 1. Governor Steve Cooper was in town yesterday. One of his missions was to call on local legislators trying to round up the votes to deal with subsistence.
We absolutely have to decide on this subsistence issue. We've got to do it. The vehicle has to be decided on, and we've got to go back into special session and do what's necessary to retain state management of fish and wildlife resources. That's one of the issues that we fought statehood over. People got tired of having to petition some bureaucrat in Washington to decide whether they could go hunting or not. People aren't going to like that very much around here. I think that if we don't hop to it and come to some kind of reasonable conclusion here, that we run that risk. People are going to wake up one morning and the federal government's run off with Fish and Wildlife Management Authority. People don't quite understand the implications of this yet.
Cooper says so far he doesn't have the votes to warrant calling a special session, but he says there are still enough people who are flexible. He thinks sooner or later he'll get the votes to solve the problem. But he says if he gets enough solid no votes to deny the two-thirds majority any measure needs at this point, there's no reason for a special session. And he says the only viable solutions are the ones his office has come up with.
I've said all along that if we're able to preserve rural subsistence use and if we're able to preserve fish and wildlife management within the state, that I'll consider just about any kind of solution. Now, it turns out that the only ones being considered are the ones that we are putting together. Other people's solutions just aren't very realistic, including the solution that so many people are talking about. Don't worry, just sue the federal government. That just isn't realistic. I know it's a nice, simple way of getting around the issue, but it won't work. And so We've just got to look at other types of ways to resolve this problem.
Cooper concedes the state may have to file a lawsuit anyway, but says it's likely to lose, and it would take 4 years to decide the issue. While it's pending, the federal government will have control. Even though he doesn't like the idea of a federal takeover, Cooper says the draft plan for federal management that's been proposed by the U.S. Department of Interior looks pretty good.
We worked very closely with Interior in drafting those regulations, we being our state office in Washington, D.C. They are pretty innocuous, fairly consistent with what we've got on the board right now. But all of that is based on the assumption that this is a temporary problem, that we're going to fix it, that the state will continue to manage fish and wildlife resources even on federal land here. Now, if it develops that federal government realizes that they are permanently in charge of fish and wildlife resources, that things are going to change very quickly, because those regulations and rules are going to reflect Washington politics and not Alaska politics. You have got outfits like the animal rights groups wandering around the halls in Washington. We think that those people are not serious around here. Let me tell you, they are in Washington, D.C. People take the animal rights movement very seriously in Washington. The first place they'll move is against trapping. The next place they'll go is against anything that's defined as sport hunting. And then I think subsistence hunting is going to be in jeopardy. So anybody that wants to take that risk, it's fine. Let's have federal management. But I'm against it. I think we ought to retain control ourselves.
Because the state Supreme Court overturned Alaska's subsistence law and the legislature hasn't changed anything, on July 1st, the federal government will take over managing subsistence hunting and fishing on federal lands here. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Outgoing UA President Donald O'Dowd was glad to see the pay hikes approved during his last meeting with the Board of Regents. He says the increase is really only a token, considering how little employees have been able to get in the last 6 years.
We've had a 4% pay raise in 85 and one in 89, and so we are so far behind in some way the level of salary advancement that I hope people could attain. But, you know, it's sort of marginal. I'm glad to be able to do it. I wish we could have done a lot more.
Permanent employees will also get one-time bonus checks with money the legislature approved for retroactive pay raises this fiscal year. Full-time employees will get some $500, and part-time employees get half that amount. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. A pay raise of 4.5% was okayed by the regents, even though the legislature didn't provide enough money for the full amount. Administrators say the 4.5% can be done this year, and most of the regents agree. A couple of them feel it is more than the system can afford. Gordon Evans says he supports a pay raise and wishes it could be more, but he has concerns that the 4.5% is too much.
I'm not so sure that we're going to have the money for the extra amount of the pay raise without cutting programs. And at least at two of the campuses, because the chancellors are both said that it would require some really close looking at where they could come up with the extra money. But at least one of the chancellors, he says he doesn't know right now where he's going to come up with it. And so I just don't think the money's there.
If the system's funding doesn't improve in the future, Evans says the Board of Regents won't be able to make major cuts and downsize the system as some suggest. Other regents say downsize isn't the word they prefer. They suggest reallocation of resources or focused growth is what lies ahead. Outgoing UA President Donald O'Dowd doesn't believe drastic changes will result.
Oh, no, I don't see us closing campuses. I don't think the public would accept it, and I don't think the regents would do it. We just find some way of putting it together. There's no likelihood that the demand for higher education is going to be reduced in the state. Now, it seems to me we should constantly refine what we do and use our resources more wisely, and I know we can do that, and I hope that will happen. But in terms of the institution getting smaller, I just don't see that as being very likely to happen.
O'Dowd was pleased to see the raises approved, only the third pay hike that's been given in his 6 years as president. He says he only wishes it could be more. Employees will also get bonus checks in the month ahead, the result of nearly $2 million that the legislature unexpectedly provided to be used for retroactive pay raises this year. The university decided that full-time employees working from January to May will get checks of equal amounts of more than $500. Part-time permanent employees will get half that amount. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
There is general agreement in the scientific community that greenhouse warming will occur. The National Academy of Sciences, for example, underwrites this greenhouse scenario, but they put big error bars on it. They say the warming will occur at about 3 degrees centigrade, 5 degrees Fahrenheit, plus minus 1.5 degrees. So the least amount of warming that we can expect, according to the Academy, is 1.5 degrees centigrade, up to 4.5 degrees centigrade in the lower latitudes, and twice that amount in high latitudes. The verdict is not in yet, and we have to wait and see what develops. We have to look at the problem more. However, the problem is serious enough that some attention should be paid to it.
I don't want to say that all of global warming is due to this or global change is due to this, but what I want to emphasize here is that this is an effect that needs to be considered before you can determine whether there's actually global warming. And it's I would say it's a complicating factor on any measurements that you make. But it's important for Alaska at least, and it could be important for the climate over the United States too, because water temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska could have an influence over the drought and flood cycle in the western U.S. And there are some thoughts that that we do have this 15 to 20 year cycle.
Three, two, one. The new restrictions only apply to a specific part of downtown Fairbanks, what's considered the core. The city estimates that there are 16 liquor licenses in that downtown core area, but only about 4 of the license holders stay open until 5 a.m., currently the latest they can. The new ordinance, effective July 1st, calls for a 2 a.m. closure on weekdays and 3 a.m. on weekends. Liquor stores in the area will have to close 1 hour earlier. And instead of reopening at 8 a.m., doors must stay closed until 11 o'clock in the morning. The measure is supported by businesses and residents downtown. The city council heard from them at last night's public hearing on the ordinance. Kathleen Owen says she's lived at the Golden Towers for 6 years and hasn't known what a good night's sleep is.
And it's drunk. And it's urinating on your car. All over the pretty flowers that are put out to make the place look good.
Martin Tomlinson with the Fairbanks Downtown Association presented a petition with more than 300 signatures supporting the ordinance.
Some of the businesses that have signed this petition: Kohler, Schmidt, and Hutchinson, Teresa's Northwood Airport, Greatland Hotel, Larson's Fine Jewelers, Co-op Drug and Soda.
Fairbanks Police Chief Richard Cummings pushed for the new ordinance. The logic is that it will reduce the number of complaints from downtown residents and the need for police patrols, which have been requested for the downtown core, but the city lacks the money to provide that manpower. And the change is expected to decrease the amount of crime caused by drunks downtown all night. But opponents say the measure picks on bars that aren't part of the problem solely because of their location. Representatives of the Elks and the Eagles were particularly upset. The Elks' Don Lynch says there are some occasions when they want to stay open late, but won't be able to with this change.
To close us down earlier than normal, when really, as far as we're concerned, we're not the cause of the problem, is to punish between 2,000 and 3,000 people for things that, quite frankly, we don't feel we have any part of.
And Joe Paskvan of Tommy's Elbow Room says it's an act of discrimination that will put that bar out of business.
This is viewed as one of the greatest threats to our business, and it's simply because of our location. You're attempting to treat us individually different than you are treating others in the same business, and again, just because of the location. It will force us out of business.
The city council member Bill Wally says that didn't happen in Juneau and Anchorage when they restricted bar hours. and he doesn't think it will happen here. Wally sees it as a public safety concern and says if there are other solutions to the problems downtown, they haven't come up with them yet, so this is a place to start. Wally was one of three council members supporting the ordinance, and with three opposed, Mayor Jim Nordale cast the tie-breaking vote in favor of the change. Nordale says he went into the meeting opposed to the ordinance, but changed his mind.
I changed my mind based upon what the testimony of some of the people was, and I feel that probably, in, on balance, the greater good is achieved by limiting the bar hours. That is the greatest good for the majority of the people.
Nordale says he's not sure the measure will have the desired effect, though, and should get another look after it's been tried. Councilmember Jerry Norum, who voted against it, says a cooperative attitude will make the difference downtown, not an ordinance limiting bar hours in a select area.
But I had to vote no on the basis of the reality that you can't punish everybody for, you know, the bad behavior of a few.
Norum also says the city will find itself immediately in court over the matter. And Larry Hackenmiller of the Interior Restaurant and Beverage Association says that's a possibility.
I think there was a pretty good hint tonight that they were being penalized strictly because of their location, which would probably be illegal, you know, discriminatory. And I think that's a good case there. I'm not an attorney. However, I think if some action were to be filed, it would be along those lines.
Herb Kuth is an attorney for the city of Fairbanks. Kuth says it's discriminatory, but it's selective discrimination, not illegal discrimination, since the measure is an economic regulation.
In the area of economic regulation where personal rights are not affected, if the distinction is drawn on a rational or reasonable basis, then the discrimination can be supported. And hopefully, citing the unique needs of downtown, and the various aspects of law enforcement and disproportionate burdens that supposedly have been put on law enforcement, hopefully drawing a law that does target the downtown area will be deemed to be rational and reasonable and therefore permissively discriminatory.
Last night, the city council heard several other suggested ways to solve the problems downtown as an alternative to this, but the majority say they have to start somewhere, and this is a step, even though opponents claim it's the wrong step. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Alaska Railroad spokeswoman Vivian Hamilton says during the course of the week, railroad workers are being sent to the cleanup site.
The railroad has decided to begin phasing out our contractors. We have about 100, maybe 125 contract employees at the site. The work they are doing is the kind of thing that we could use our own employees and therefore be a little bit more efficient and reduce our costs and still get the same kind of work done up there. We are at a stage now where it's just the mopping up that is being done, the final stages of the cleanup before we get into our long-term plan of testing and monitoring. And so as the week progresses, we will be phasing those out, and by at least Tuesday of next week, we think we'll have all railroaders there.
Hamilton says workers with American North will still be at the site. That's the consulting company that was hired to help the railroad with its long-term cleanup plan. Hamilton says the stage of the spill cleanup now doesn't require as many people, despite concerns raised by the Department of Environmental Conservation about the transition.
Well, they voiced their concern that it was premature, but we have demonstrated before that we have cleaned up the majority of the product out there, and the stage that we're in now, the level of work that's required does not require that many people, namely 120 people.
The railroad also held a village meeting in Minto earlier this week to talk with residents concerned about the impact of the spill there, since it happened near the Minto Flats State Game Refuge. Hamilton says besides interest in the long-term cleanup, the 30 people who showed up were also interested in working on the cleanup effort, but there aren't any plans right now to hire Minto residents.
Right now, we're going to use our own employees. But what is going on is the two contractors that we have used during our spill cleanup have offered to do free training at the village and also at the town of Nenana. So there will be a lot of training going on so that there will be people who will be employable if there are future spills that need cleaning up in Alaska.
The railroad is also in the process of making minor changes in its long-term cleanup plan for the site, changes that were requested by the Department of Environmental Conservation. The revised plan is due on Friday. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
The idea is that these meetings will give people an opportunity to comment who are not comfortable with the written medium of expression, people who feel better speaking in public or giving their testimony orally will be able to come to these meetings and give their thoughts that way.
3, 2, 1. A board committee yesterday debated whether the university system could afford 4.5% pay raises or whether it should opt for 3% increases instead. The higher percentage was urged by the administration, and it was accepted. But committee chairman Roy Hundorf says better pay will mean downsizing the system.
So it's a tough and controversial road we're headed down, and I think it's the correct one. The difficulty is forced on us by a scarcity of money and resources, and we must do what we have to do.
The board will act on that recommendation today. Regents will also take up a plan to provide bonuses to permanent employees in lump sum payments. That's a way of distributing nearly $2 million the legislature provided for retroactive pay raises. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. The Board of Regents approved a 3% salary increase for employees last fall. That was to be paid for with tuition increases and cutbacks in other areas. Regents felt then the The Board of Regents approved a 3% salary increase for employees last fall. That was to be paid for with tuition increases and cutbacks in other areas. Regents felt then that pay raises were long overdue, and they also agreed to approve a minimum increase of 3% for fiscal year 1991, which begins July 1st. Yesterday, the University of Alaska administration recommended a pay increase of 4.5% to a board committee. The state legislature provided some money to pay for those raises, but the universities will still have to streamline. University chancellors and the system president feel raises of at least that much are long overdue and necessary to at least try to keep salaries competitive. UA Vice President for Human Resources Bob Warren says that was the maximum amount the chancellors felt they could afford.
It will be tight, and indeed it will. We have faced some significant reductions in operating budgets and did absorb a compensation increase of 4% this year, totally within the existing resources of the university, and it will indeed be difficult for them to absorb the portion of that that has to come from existing funds.
Regents committee members agree performance raises are needed, but they also want to allow room for increases based on specific market conditions, and they were concerned that 4.5% hike is more than the system can afford. After discussing at length whether to reduce that amount to 3% and give the chancellors more flexibility to pay increases for market costs, they finally agreed to the 4.5% recommendation. But committee chairman Roy Hundorf says by doing that, the regents are making the commitment to better compensation for staff at the expense of cutting programs or whole campuses later on.
The picture that I perceive painted was one that is rather dire, that the future is probably not going to get better, and if we embark on a policy of paying people market rates, fair salaries, which I endorse fully, we must also recognize the fact that requires us to downsize in the future to make monies available for market level salaries.
The regents and the administration agree that by making this move, this budget year will be tight and real cuts will come in the next fiscal year. The full board is expected to act on the salary increase recommendation at today's meeting. At the same time, they'll decide how to spend nearly $2 million they unexpectedly got from the legislature for retroactive pay raises. The money must be spent before the end of this fiscal year, and the administration is recommending lump sum payments to employees on board from January to May. Some board members think that money should be used to cover the costs of raises approved earlier this year that weren't budgeted for. Vice President Warren says the lump sum payments seem the best way to go, considering the limits set on the spending.
Frankly, we don't see other options at this point. The appropriation language was such that that money was allocated for retroactive salary adjustments. If we were to utilize it for any other purpose, or if we were to attempt to lapse it and carry it forward into the next fiscal year, we would have to have specific authority from the legislature to do that.
The administration figures are that lump sum checks for the 2,800 full-time university employees would amount to more than $500 apiece. Part-time employees would get half that amount. Even though the board committee agreed to that recommendation, they want more numbers at today's meeting to see if legally they can apply those funds to money that's already been spent on raises approved for this fiscal year. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.